The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Sports Talk 1240. Here we are. Eric Getzoff joined by David Underweiser on this Sunday night, November 22nd. David and I actually used to host a show back in high school. That was 5 years ago. Crazy how time has flown by. David, how are you?
I'm good, man. No complaints. Happy to be here on a Sunday night after a day of football. Wish the Jets would have made my day go a little better, but here we are.
Yeah, feels good to be back on the air.
Definitely, man. I haven't been back on since I graduated at Binghamton. Enjoyed the days there. Enjoyed having you on your show, myself, and you call in for my show. So it was great.
Perfect. So we got a jam-packed show for everybody today. We'll be joined by Howard Beck, who covers the NBA on Bleacher Report. We have a lot of questions to talk to him about the Knicks and particularly about the Nets. Most notably, the job security of the general manager and the manager are two questions that we have top of mind. Feel free to give a call in. You want to talk about the Knicks, the Nets. You want to talk about today's football games. Hey, if you want to even talk about the Yankees or the Mets, give a call in. The number is 631-888-8811. That's 631-888-8811. And now we are actually joined on the line by Howard Beck, who covers the NBA for Bleacher Report and previously covered the Knicks for the New York Times. Howard, I appreciate the time. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Appreciate it. So first question, we're going to start off with the Nets and then get to the Knicks. And it's a question that really I've been asking myself for a year plus now, and it's the job security of Billy King. So the question that I have for you is, how and why does Billy King still have a job as general manager of the Nets?
Well, you got to understand why the Nets are in the position that they're in and the context for the moves that they've made the last several years. And this is not just the Billy King show. You know, and in every organization, for that matter, there has to be some unity of opinion or direction between ownership and the front office. And in the Nets case, what you had was an owner, Mikhail Prokhorov, who came in with, you know, a lot of swagger and a lot of big talk about, you know, owning New York and winning a championship in 5 years and putting up a billboard across from the Garden that said the blueprint for greatness with Prokhorov and Jay-Z on it. He was talking big from day one, and so the marching orders were very clear. Get stars, whatever stars you can get, and get us to Brooklyn. This is while they're still in New Jersey. Get us to Brooklyn with a team that is ready to win on day one, that has stars from day one, and that can sell seats, sell season tickets at Barclays, because they weren't selling anything in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So they went and made a trade for Deron Williams. That cost them some of their future in terms of picks and flexibility and young players. And then they kept doubling down on that. You know, to get Deron Williams to stay, they needed help. So they made a big trade for Joe Johnson and sacrificed a little bit more in terms of picks and future flexibility. And then when that team won 49 games in its first year in Brooklyn, which was a respectable season, but they choked on a Game 7 on their home court against Chicago, and so they wanted to get further. And an opportunity came up to get Pearson Garnett, who had had a still decent season at that time. So they made a trade for those two guys, thinking, you know, we got to be all in. And every single one of these moves was made, you know, with the understanding that the ownership wanted to win right now and wanted to contend for championships immediately. And so that's how the Nets got to where they are. Now, if you want to quibble over details about picks that could have been protected or other, you know, parameters of individual deals, that's all fair. But the marching orders, the direction, the agenda was very clear, and it came from the very top.
Howard, so when it comes to what's going on in the Nets organization, obviously you're talking about the dynamic of the front office, the ownership, but of course that trickles down to job security with the head coach. Now, Lionel Hollins, of course, has his team off to a rather disappointing start. Now, obviously there's been a lot of changes the past few years in Brooklyn, but what do you attribute his lack of ability to coach his team, or is it the talent level? And basically, what are we looking at for Lionel Hollins? Is he going to last 82?
Well, last season, you know, part of the problem was that Lionel Hollins could not get, you know, anything out of Darren Williams in terms of you know, being on the same page. Darren Williams has been a pain for a lot of different coaches, though, going back all the way to Utah. And that's why Darren Williams was bought out in the offseason and why he's now in Dallas. The problem with that temporary solution is that they now have no point guard really on this team. Jarrett Jack has always been a good scoring guard off the bench, but he's not your, you know, your ideal skill set for a starting point guard. They've got, you know, just a bunch of other guys, you know, Shane Larkin, who was cast aside by the Knicks. And, you know, they just don't have great pieces. The backcourt is pretty bad. They've got, you know, one nice, really nice piece in Brook Lopez, who, while he scores 20 points a game, is still best as your second or third best player. Shouldn't be your best player, but he's their best player. Thaddeus Young, nice role player on a good team, but on a team that doesn't have a lot of talent, you don't want him to be your second best player, and with this group, he probably is. Joe Johnson, who should be one of their top two players, is 34 years old and is either shot or disinterested or just wants to move on. Who knows? He's in the last year of his deal. I'm sure if they can trade him by the trade deadline to a team that could use somebody like him, they will. If not, maybe he gets bought out. But, I mean, they're in a transitional phase here. You know, the experiment didn't work. The big three that they put together clearly did not work. They're down to just two of those guys now in Joe Johnson and Brook Lopez. The Pierce and Garnett thing didn't work. So it's they just have to keep trying to acquire interesting young pieces and try to develop guys. They had a good draft run to Hollis Jefferson. They're just trying to figure out what the next move is. And they've got cap room next summer, but you know what? So does everybody. So there is no clear direction for this team right now.
Talking about clear direction, it looks like Derek Fisher definitely has a more laser focus when it comes to how he wants to handle his team in year two. What's the biggest difference you see through him through 14 games?
He has talent to actually coach now. I mean, the team he inherited was pretty messed up in the first place. That was a 37-win team, and you know they just started trying to figure out who belonged and who didn't. So they dumped J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert, and, of course, they'd already traded Tyson Chandler. And, you know, Carmelo gets hurt. You know, the 17-win season, people have been so fixated on it being, you know, obviously the worst season in Knicks history based on just the win total. But, you know, lost in all of that is that Carmelo Anthony was hurt for about half the season and then gone for the other half of the season after surgery. And the drop-off from Carmelo to their next best player, whoever that might be, was massive. And then they went into basically, you know, a just play out the string mode and just test out young guys and, you know, tanking if you want to use that term. So there wasn't much there. This is a brand new team. Robin Lopez, Aaron Aflalo, Kyle O'Quinn, Porzingis, of course, and the continued emergence of Galloway, Jaren Grant, the rookie. They just got a lot of really good, solid pieces now, and Carmelo is healthy again. And Porzingis is playing at a level that I don't think they expected for another year or two. So, you know, the decisions become a lot easier for a coach when you've actually got talent to coach. And last season, that wasn't even the case.
Sports Talk 1240, Eric Getzoff and David Underweiser here with you, joined by Howard Beck, who writes for the NBA for Bleacher Report. Howard, staying on the topic of Derek Fisher, there are some games he'll go like 9 or 10 deep. He'll play Jerry and Grant for like 20 minutes, and other games where Jerry and Grant will play 6 minutes. You know, there are other games where Derek Williams will get a lot of playing time, and then other games where Derek Williams will just not play at all. So do you see him shortening that lineup come the middle of the season once he gets a more firm understanding of where everybody kind of meshes in together?
Well, I think this is a team where you've got a lot of even talent. You know, Carmelo is on another level, obviously. Robin Lopez is clearly your best center, your best big man. I guess, actually, Porzingis might steal that title any day now for best big man. But you've got a lot of guys in terms of, you know, the guards. You know, Calderon has the know-how and the three-point shot, but he doesn't have any foot speed anymore and he can't defend. Vujicic, kind of similar. Galloway and Grant, great energy and great skill sets, but really, really young. Don't have the same kind of know-how that a Calderon has or that a Vujicic has or that an Aflalo has. And again, Aflalo was hurt to start the season. He's just starting to get back, you know, or get into a rhythm. So when you've got a bunch of guys, and, you know, you want to talk about Kylo Quinn or Derek Williams, you've got a lot of guys who are similar. They're not necessarily similar in skill set, but they're all somewhere in that middle range of NBA player. And when you've just brought a team together, and again, this entire roster for the most part is new, aside from Calderon and Carmelo, there's a lot of kind of hunting and pecking that goes on as a coach to find, you know, what can guys do, who's best in the fourth quarter, who's best in certain situations, which units work best together, which, you know, two guys, three guys, four guys, five guys. You have to kind of figure that out as you go. There's no data points to look at, whether we're talking literal data points in terms of the advanced stats about lineups or just visual data points, what you've observed. You can't figure that out until you've had enough time for these guys to all play together and play in different combinations. So will the rotation eventually get shorter? Maybe. Or maybe it's just that they've got a bunch of guys who, again, as I say, are so in the same range in terms of skill sets that maybe you'll go 9-10 deep in your rotation for the whole season, which has its benefits. You know, Derek Williams, he's, you know, a guy who's very streaky. You know, there are games he's very effective and games he's not, so you're going to cut his minutes at times. With rookies like Grant, again, there are games where you have to have a shorter rope because maybe he's not quite on point. So it's way too early to say these are the, you know, eight guys that he should stick with night in, night out, and in this exact order.
So another question staying on the Knicks with Carmelo Anthony. You know, obviously he was injured last year, and now you get Kristaps Porzingis come the draft. So it was kind of funny to me because Carmelo was not that happy, obviously, with the pick of Kristaps Porzingis back in June. But have you seen a change in Carmelo's leadership, in particular with taking Porzingis under his wing and tutelage in Porzingis' rookie season here?
I don't know about tutelage. I mean, that's a hard thing to gauge unless you're in the gym every day, and I'm not. But he certainly seems to be supportive, and he certainly seemed to be, in general, forget about Porzingis, Carmelo just looks like he's making more of an effort, more of the time, to keep the ball moving, to involve guys, to try to draw on the defense and make smart passes to guys. He's never been a big assist guy, Carmelo. And last I checked, and I'm not sure if the numbers are changed through last night's game, but as of a couple of days ago, he was on pace to tie his career high in assists per game, which I think is like 3.8. And he's rarely even over three in his career. Most seasons he's, you know, in the low threes or even below. He's just never been a big assist guy. He's a guy who, as we know, dominates the ball, sometimes pounds the ball. I feel like most of the games I've seen this season, there is more of a focus by Carmelo to keep it moving, to make the quick decision. If he's going to shoot, he's going to do it, you know, fairly quickly, a couple of moves and go, as opposed to all that isolation, ball stalling, offense stalling kind of approach. And that helps guys like Porzingis. That helps everybody. So I've been encouraged by that, for sure.
Looking at this rotation, specifically the guys under Carmelo, it looks like there's a lot of cohesiveness coming together. I mean, we're only through 14 games, and this is a lot of new faces in new places here in New York for the Knicks. But do you see this team growing as a cohesive unit as the season continues to roll on?
I think so, because you don't have egos in this case. I mean, Carmelo's certainly got a fairly, you know, substantial ego, but there's nobody else on this roster who's, you know, got star stamped on them. Porzingis maybe sometime in the future, but he's a rookie. He's 20 years old, and you can tell he's, you know, right now he's just pleased to be able to be a contributor. I don't see anybody else on this roster where you're going to say, oh, these guys are competing for shots. And it doesn't even have to be a star, by the way. It could be a guy like a Nick Young who acts like he's a star. You know, those kind of guys can screw you up. The Knicks don't have anybody like that. There's no gunners on this team. There's nobody going out there trying to, you know, get numbers for the sake of numbers. Nobody's on a salary drive. They all just got here. Nobody with anything to prove. So it that lends itself to cohesion. I also think that Phil Jackson and his front office, in remaking this team and essentially flushing the entire roster that they inherited, aside from Carmelo, they have gone after you know, high IQ basketball players and guys with high character, you know, guys like Robin Lopez and Aaron Aflalo, who have been around a while, who don't, you know, fixate on their stats, who set a good example, who are going to work hard, who are smart guys, and then it all flows from there. And I think they've got themselves a really good group. And, that can pay a lot of dividends because it makes it easier, I think, to create that cohesion that you're alluding to.
If there's one weakness that I see on the Knicks here, it's defense at the point guard position. So I guess my question would be, will the combination of Calderon and Grant be able to stop elite point guards in the East? And I know I'm getting ahead of myself here talking playoffs. The Knicks are 8-6, so of course we're only in November. But that's just, it just came to my attention because you have a lot of elite point guards in the East in terms of Kyrie, Derrick Rose, Jeff Teague. So, like, do you think that Calderon and Grant will be able to kind of keep up and be able to stop those point guards?
Well, Calderon, no. Vujicic, no. Grant and Galloway, maybe. And when we say, I say maybe, I'm not saying stop, because with the elite point guards, you don't stop them, but you got to make them work, and you got to be able to stay in front of them. And you can't allow everything to just be, you can't create a situation where your bigs are constantly the ones having to stop penetration, because that's just going to put guys in foul trouble. It wrecks your defense. You need to have guards who can stay in front of their man. And I do wonder long term, and when I say long term, I mean within this season, whether they'll be able to stick with Jose Calderon at point guard. I feel like he's got that job locked down as the starter, and the minutes he's getting based largely on his, you know, his veteran status and his leadership status and the respect people have for him, as opposed to what he's actually capable of doing right now. So I don't know if that works long term. Aflalo's a pretty good defender, so you know sometimes you might be able to switch him onto the point guard. But you know, I don't know how many shooting guards you want Calderon trying to guard either. You know, it's going to be hard to hide him. So you know, those are decisions to make down the road. I know there's a lot of fans out there who would love to see Grant and Galloway starting instead. And you know, now that Aflalo's back, they've got a little bit more leeway. When they started the season with Vujicic and Calderon, that was, you know, defensively that was just about as bad as you were going to get in the backcourt. But all things for them to figure out as they go.
So switching gears from Eastern Conference teams over to the West, talking some Houston Rockets now. Kevin McHale, right after a 4-7 start to the season, obviously highlighted by those final four consecutive blowout losses. What's the deal there? I mean, this is a guy who led his team to the Western Conference Finals just the end of last season. Obviously, this is only 11 months since he signed that three-year contract extension to remain the head coach. What happened? What happened beforehand?
Well, there's a lot of different things going on in Houston, but when it comes to the McHale firing, let's just skip past all the details and get to this, which is they weren't responding anymore. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in Houston. The bottom line is, you know, there are times, and I've seen this happen over and over in this league, even with a great head coach, even with a guy like McHale, who obviously everyone respects and has, you know, great regard for what he's accomplished in his career as a player, sometimes you get a group of players that tune a coach out. And, you know, wherever you want to lay that blame, go ahead. But once it happens, it's almost impossible to get back. And it sounded premature. It's only 11 games into the season. I know people thought it was hasty. But you have to recognize as an organization when you reach a point of no return with relationships, whether it's your two star players or your star player and your coach. And when you see that it's reached the end of the line, if you can't get it back, you have to move. And they're not going to trade Harden and Howard. They're not going to trade the entire lineup. That's an impossibility. So as desperate as it seems, as unjustified as it may seem to a lot of people, the only choice you have there is fire the coach and hope that the guy you put in that chair, in this case J.B. Bickerstaff, gets a better result. So far that hasn't been the case, but, you know, they are still hopeful, I believe. And, you know, the talent is there. But, you know, Harden, by a lot of accounts, people I've talked to, did not show up to camp in the best of shape. There are concerns about him and then the way he's conducted himself off the court. Dwight missed a bunch of games early in the season. Patrick Beverley missed a bunch of games, so they haven't been healthy. Vota Hunis, who was their preferred starting power forward for most of last season, he hasn't played at all because he's still recovering from a back injury. So there's a lot of things going on, health, chemistry, all of it, and unfortunately that cost McHale his job.
The thing I don't understand with that, though, is so And like I noticed this also, obviously, from the poor start. They were losing games by, like, 15 points. Like, how does a team kind of just go from making the Western Conference Finals, winning 45 games in three straight years, and then just not responding to the coach? It's just kind of confusing.
It is confusing. There's no question. It's beyond baffling, and nobody saw this coming. You know, there are doubts around the league about Harden and Howard as stars. About, these are guys who are not considered leaders, who, you know, certainly, you know, they put up the numbers, especially in Harden's case, puts up the numbers, and Dwight Howard's been a phenomenal defender as well. And, you know that you can ride them to a certain extent, but they've always both been considered a little bit unreliable in terms of character, in terms of what you're going to get from them on day in, day out, in terms of work ethic and leadership. So those are the aspects of the Houston Rockets where maybe that conference finals run was a little misleading. You know, maybe they overachieved a little bit. Mm-hmm. Everybody wanted to fix it on the Warriors somehow catching breaks. Maybe the Rockets got a few breaks. They got a Clipper team that completely collapsed in the second round. So maybe they shouldn't have been that far in the first place. But, look, they still were a 55-win team and one that had, you know, one of the better 1-2 punches in the league when healthy than Harden and Howard. But, yeah, sometimes things just go down the tubes in a hurry. And this is one of those cases, and it's not always easy to explain.
So watching the NFL last week, there was a quarterback by the name of Peyton Manning who kind of reminded me of a current NBA player in the name of Kobe Bryant, who both are all-time great players, and both were actually kind of at the peak of their game in the same time, you know, for both of their careers. And now both are kind of winding down, both have injuries at the end of their career, and it's kind of sad to see both of them play, knowing what they both were capable of throughout their careers. So, you know, comparing Kobe and Peyton, what they're doing right now, which one, in your opinion, is kind of hurting their legacy? And I know this is kind of an NFL question, too, so I'm hoping that you watch a little bit of NFL. But, you know, which one, in your opinion, is hurting their legacy a little bit, you know, more in their career by, you know, this season and last season?
I don't know how to answer that exactly. So I'll just speak to Kobe in this case. I don't think that Kobe can hurt his legacy, and I'm guessing Peyton Manning can't either.
We got Howard? Nope. I think we lost Howard. We're going to try and get him back. But, yeah, that's actually a question that came to my mind the other day. I was talking to my dad about all-time great players who kind of went down at the end of their career. And Kobe and Peyton Manning, you know, Peyton Manning was drafted in 98. Kobe was drafted in 96. And both were at the peak of their performances at the same time. And now both are kind of winding down. It's a little sad to see. We're going to get Howard back on, hopefully, in the next couple of minutes. But, Dave, I want to ask you this question because the drive over here, we both were kind of talking about this. Both are going to be first bat Hall of Famers without a doubt. So which one do you think is kind of hurting their legacy more, you know, currently?
You know, it's interesting because you look at a guy like Kobe, obviously in the championship department and the ring department, you know, Kobe has that one covered. You can talk about what the pinnacle of Peyton Manning's career has looked like, and you can say his MVPs might have Kobe beat. But looking at both of these players, I think you're looking at leaders. Now, obviously, different styles of leaders. But if I were to be honest with you here, I truly think that neither one, I agree with Howard, is going to tarnish their legacy and leave a sour taste in their mouth. However, looking back, this is not the pretty way you want to remember either of these two greats.
Yeah, and it's sad, too, because you can go back and you can think of all-time great players who kind of went sour at the end of their career. You talk about Allen Iverson. He went out with the Grizzlies, with the Pistons, and it was just kind of sad to see because that's not the guy you know him for. You talk about guys such as Joe Namath who – the guy was great in Super Bowl III, but really, in the last 3-4 years of his career, no one, he just was not the same player, and no one wanted to see him go out that way. So it just, it stinks. Like, you don't want to see these guys like this, but they don't want to give up. So that, it's kind of, as a player, it's a balance between when do I give up and when do I let it go. Between I love this game and I now want to keep playing. And we would never know that. We're both not athletes, but this is what goes through their minds.
And it's crazy to think, if you look at this situation, it's easy to say, okay, we're looking at these guys at towards the end of their careers, past their prime and all that, but cycling the the clock a little bit further back, these guys, both Peyton and Kobe, were specialized in their sports from a very young age. So when you look at what their comfort zone is, what their comfort factors are, this is it. And yeah. I think more in the case of Kobe than Peyton, just because I know Peyton has his investments on the side. I'm sure Kobe has his own things too. But this is their identity. So obviously they're not playing to the up to the ability that they've done. You know, they're not absolutely the worst in their position in their leagues. However, this cannot be the Peyton Manning or Kobe Bryant you're used to seeing, but it's who they are. It's their identity. That's what they wake up for in the morning.
It is. It is. And to answer that question, I think that Kobe's hurting his legacy just a little bit more. Again, it really doesn't matter. You're not going to remember Kobe Bryant for what he's doing this year or last year, or Peyton Manning for what he's doing this year. But I just think, I mean, look at the last year, 3 years for Kobe. He has not been the Kobe that you knew him for. And the last time we really saw the Kobe that we knew him for was at the tail end of the 2012-2013 season when he was extremely close, and I think he was extremely close to leading the Lakers to the playoffs after Dwight Howard went down with an injury and Steve Nash was out for the year, and that was the first time he got hurt. So that was the last time we knew the Kobe Bryant that we really remembered him for, and it's been basically 2.5 seasons since then. You had 13-14 pass, 14-15 pass, and that was 15-16, and Kobe really has not molded into his own. So I just think that the answer to that question, again, there's no right or wrong answer, or it probably doesn't even affect it. But Kobe, after, you know, for the past 3 years, has just not been himself.
And that's a good point, Eric. And I think what also kind of plays to the favor of Peyton Manning is when you close your eyes, do you see Peyton wearing blue and white for the Colts, or do you see him wearing that Bronco orange in Mile High? So I think a lot of what he's doing now can obviously never have an effect on what he did in Indianapolis, how he won the Super Bowl, how he won those MVPs. With Kobe, on the other hand, all you know is purple and gold out in L.A. for him.
Yep. So we'll continue this conversation the second half of the show. It's 9:30, so we're going to take our first break. Thank you, Howard Beck, for coming on. I know we lost him a little bit. Cell phone signals can kind of stink nowadays. But, hey, for the amount of information that he gave us for how long he was on, we really appreciate it. We'll be back for the second half of the show where we will touch on the football that went on today. The Jets did not play great. We'll talk about that for a little bit. We'll get into the Philadelphia Eagles and talk about the Mets as well. So we'll be right back on Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240.
broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
And we are back talking sports. Eric Getzoff alongside David Underweiser. We got both of us here. Of course, a big thanks to Howard Beck, who came on for the first portion of the show, dropping some knowledge on that NBA discussion, Knicks, Nets, and Rockets, and that firing. But, of course, we want to move over to some NFL football. And what would we say before we get into NFL football if we didn't go into what's going on right this minute over in Arizona at the University of Phoenix Stadium, a 7-7 tie. You got Bengals and Cardinals, two-minute warning over in Arizona. And that's definitely a good game. But looking at today as a whole, if we're speaking locally as our New York fans, we're very disappointed in the New York Jets. Obviously, the Giants on bye this week. Talk about a win, having them get that rest late in the season. But kind of starting off with the New York Jets. Now, they play a Houston team that comes off a very big win, an upset last week. And I wonder if some of that momentum, if some of that ability to quiet some of the question marks surrounding a disappointing start to the season for the Texans played a role in this one. And I don't want to give them too much credit, Eric, because the New York Jets really didn't come to play. I think they might have left their resolve, their toughness, and their mental focus, talking about some key penalties down the stretch, in New York when they went to Houston.
Yeah, it was a bad game for the Jets. I mean, this game really showed you what the Jets were about. They don't have an elite quarterback who can make plays down the stretch. Today, they did not have a running game at all. And speaking of running game, what has happened to Chris Ivory? Because the first half of the year, this guy, I'm not even kidding, was considered to be a top four running back in the NFL. I mean, he was putting up games with 150, 130, 120 rushing yards consistently. Today, the Jets as a whole, as a team, had 70 rushing yards, only 21 attempts. And again, down the stretch, Ryan Fitzpatrick shows you who he really is. And, you know, you can't fault Fitzpatrick because the guy is not an elite quarterback. So the Jets right now just are not in a position to win games down the stretch because of their personnel. Going back to the Texans for a second, this is an interesting team. This is a team that started out 2-5 that was embarrassed by the Dolphins in the first half against Miami. They gave up, I believe it was over 35 points. And now, all of a sudden, they've won three straight games. They're 5-5. Dave, the AFC is extremely, extremely interesting.
You know, it's wacky because you have some conferences, some divisions, speaking AFC and NFC, where you need to almost be perfect to take it. Talking about the AFC East, and then you're looking at divisions where right now the New York Giants at 5-5 are sitting pretty atop the NFC East. Yeah. So it's just one of those things where the season has yet to play out completely. At the end of the day, if you're nothing better than 8-8, you're probably not going to sniff the playoffs. But that being said, looking at this Jets team and going back to your running game point, could it be that Ivory's banged up? Probably. Now, who isn't banged up at this portion of the season? Mm-hmm. That's an important question. But what kills the New York Jets is you are not going to have a guy like Fitzpatrick who is going to shred defenses, which means he needs that rushing game to open up the flow of his offense. He needs that rhythm. He needs that time of possession. Another thing, you look at this Jets defense who's been banged up on the secondary. They did get Cromartie back. They did get Screen back. What's the best thing you can do for your defense is keep them off the field. And today, the New York Jets did not win the possession battle.
They did not win the possession battle at all. Speaking of the Jets' defense, Terrell Revis was burnt today. I mean, this is a guy who looked like he aged 10 years in a matter of 2 weeks. DeAndre Hopkins, listen, I'm going to give him credit. He's one of the top receivers in the league. But Terrell Revis has been talked about as being one of the best cornerbacks of all time. So what was that today? I mean, this is a crucial game against the team who was 4-5 before going into today. This was a crucial game for AFC wildcard implications. And honestly, it could come down to a head-to-head matchup between the Jets and Texans at the end of the year. And Terrell Revis, a guy who brings so much attention to himself, calls himself Revis Island, this and that. Where was this guy today in a game that you needed him for?
You know, here in 2015, almost 2016, I think I may utter the first time I had the word Darrell Revis and human in the same sentence, because for the prior time in the NFL, he has been beyond human. He has been a known entity, a consistent fixture when it came to stopping the top flight receiver game in and game out. And I think the fact that he shows some level of humanity, making mistakes, getting burned. How about that quick move that Hopkins pulled on Revis on that little stutter route that ended up giving Hopkins the touchdown? Revis just looked flat out, flat. And I don't know if it's a matter of his age catching up. I don't know if it's a matter of the fact that the Jets' secondary hasn't been up to snuff, with the exception of Revis, at some points during this year. I'm not worried that he's going to be a detriment to the defense going forward. But at the same time, you have to take note, and you have to realize maybe at some point in a player's career, you have to tweak the system around them. You cannot be the I'm the Rex Ryan coach who's going to say, Darrell Revis, we're shutting down this quarter of the field, this side of the field. Todd Bowles has to look at Revis and say, we got a great cornerback. He's going to be good day in and day out. But he ain't perfect anymore, and we have to account for that.
Yeah, he wasn't good in that Bill game, too, 2 weeks ago as well. Listen, two things that stick out in my mind that you mentioned prior were the penalties. The Jets committed 7 penalties for 54 yards, and time of possession was absolutely – I mean, it came out to 33-25 for the Houston and 26-35 for the Jets, but it seemed like Houston had the ball for, so much longer, and it seemed like they were in the red zone much more often than the Jets were. So it's going to kill you in games like this where you don't have a quarterback who is going to win games for you. The biggest thing for me wasn't the Jets scoring 17 points, but Houston scoring 24, because this is a team that really doesn't have much offense at all. They're playing their third string quarterback. The Jets supposedly have one of the best defenses in the entire league. Again, where that was today, it remains to be seen. The good thing for the Jets, though, moving forward, is that they do have a very favorable schedule. They play the Giants in 2 weeks. Next week, they get the Dolphins at home. The Dolphins, it's crazy. The Dolphins always seem to get – I'm sorry, was that game in London an away game for the Dolphins, for the Jets?
Yep. That game in London was actually a home game for the Dolphins.
Okay, so
yep.
This game is going to be a home game for the Jets. It's weird because I feel like whenever the Jets play the Dolphins at home, you would know this a little bit more than me because you're a bigger Jet fan. Obviously, you are the Jet fan. I'm a Giant fan. Doesn't it seem like the Dolphins always give the Jets fits at MetLife?
100%. And, that even goes back to Giant Stadium or, wherever the Jets are playing during that season. Now, obviously you have that rivalry, obviously you have that history, but when you look at both of these teams, they're both in similar situations. I think there's talent on both sides of the ball. You look at everything that the Dolphins have done to beef up that defense. Obviously, Sue, the big signing in the offseason for the Finns, but you have a quarterback in Tannehill who you think has some talent. You have some receivers around him who have the ability to step up. You have Lamar Miller in the backfield. Not necessarily a poor team, but at bare minimum, a mediocre team. But once again, the Miami Dolphins and the New York Jets are plagued by the same issue. If they fall behind, neither of those teams have the quarterback that are going to pick up the offense and say, we're going 80 yards down the field in 3 minutes.
Yep, and the biggest disappointment for me at quarterback for this year, which there are many. Andrew Luck's been a disappointment. Aaron Rodgers, you take away this week, has not been that good. Colin Kaepernick, whatever, go on so far and so forth. But Ryan Tannehill has not had a great year at all. And this is a guy who I thought was going to take a leap in his third year, behind center. And he just got a contract extension, too, for the Dolphins. They had a lot of high expectations. But Ryan Tannehill has not had a great year at all. The Jets and the Dolphins are plagued by the same problem. That's pretty obvious. But looking down the stretch for the Jets for their upcoming schedule, you have the Dolphins at home. You got the Giants on the road, which is, whatever, technically a home game. You got the Titans. You're in Dallas, which could be a harder game than some people think. You're home against the Patriots and at Buffalo. And you know what's weird, David, is that in the NFL, things change so constantly. So you looked at this schedule that the Jets had remaining 2-3 weeks ago, and you said that it was going to be a cakewalk. Now I'm not so sure because the Giants, though they didn't play, though they didn't win against the Patriots, they're a formidable team. That's not an easy game. The Cowboys getting Tony Romo back. And then you got the Patriots and at Buffalo. So some people thought that this was going to be an easy second half of the schedule for the Jets. And I'm looking at these six remaining games. I don't know how much – I don't know how easy it's going to be for them.
You know, it kind of feels like that 4-1 start was light years ago when you look at the New York Jets. Now, upcoming game, of course, Miami's important. Of course, the divisional, especially the AFC East foe, is a very important win. But the Jets have to play quality football to get to that Week 17 game, which obviously will have great implications on their playoff chances when they go up to Buffalo in January. Who wants to do that, go up to Buffalo in January? And when you look at this schedule, I think you cannot get caught up in what is this team doing now. You made a good point about the Dallas Cowboys. They welcome Romo back this week. A lot of these teams are strengthening as the season goes on. Now, obviously, there's unforeseen circumstances. Any injuries can happen. But the Jets just have to put their head down and focus and study up on the Miami Dolphins because it all starts there. Let's get back over 500. Let's leave at 6-5 when we head out to finish the rest of the season.
Yep. A little update on Sunday Night Football. The Bengals lead the Arizona Cardinals 14-7 in an actually very interesting game. Two teams that really don't get much press coverage, but two teams that are one of the better teams in their conference. So 14-7, the score in Sunday Night Football. Also, Dave Roberts was hired by the Los Angeles Dodgers to replace Don Mattingly as their next manager moving forward. Mattingly kind of got a bad rap there in L.A. Then again, it's sometimes when you make the playoffs for three straight years and you don't make the World Series at all with the talent that he had, I guess you got to make a change on that. But we're going to stay with the NFL for a little bit. We'll get into the Mets talk a little bit later. If you want to give a call in, feel more than welcome to, and you can talk about whatever you would like. The number is 631-888-8811. Once again, 631-888-8811. We got Eric Getzoff and David Underweiser here in studio. Brian Graves, the fabulous producer, clicking all the buttons behind the scenes. So staying on the topic of the NFL, a team that really had high expectations early in the season, a team that from a city that I went to school in, so I'm very, very, very familiar with their fan base and how they react, as I'm sure everybody is the Philadelphia Eagles. They've been a huge disappointment this year. They got, David, they didn't even lose at home today to the Buccaneers. They got steamrolled. They got crushed. How about them?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the NFL contingency, a lot of the reporters, a lot of the other front offices were like scratching their head. Chip Kelly, this guy comes in, gets keys to the car, gets to drive it wherever he pleases, ships off a number of key pieces. I mean, you look at him losing Macklin, losing DeSean Jackson, losing LeSean McCoy, basically having it his way. And so far, it hasn't panned out this season. Now, obviously, the guy does have some talent when it comes to coaching people, but when you get steamrolled to the tune of 45-17 by a rookie quarterback who throws five touchdowns, you have to look at this defense, look at this team as a whole, and say, we really got to tighten things up, or the NFC East, albeit not a runaway division, is going to fall through the fingertips and the grasps of the Eagles real quick.
Yeah, and luckily for the Eagles, the NFC East is a dreadful division. The Giants currently lead it at 5-5. And listen, Sam Bradford got injured. Sanchez comes in. It kind of stinks when you're an NFL head coach and you have your backup quarterback playing for you. But my real problem, and I don't have a problem with the LeSean McCoy for Kiko Alonso trade. No problem with that. Listen, if you want to let Jeremy Maclin go, that's fine. Jordan Matthews has been pretty good at wide receiver this year, as you know, Riley Cooper has been solid. So they've had a lot of good guys in their receiving corps. The biggest problem I had, and I still will never get this, trading Nick Foles in a second round pick for Sam Bradford, for a guy who really, I think he's played a full NFL season once in his career. Why are you doing that traded? I will always be scratching my head there.
You know, it's interesting because Bradford, of course, that last quarterback in that class of NFL rookies before the rookie wage scale was in place, so he made the big money, the first overall pick out of Oklahoma. Now, there's no doubt the talent's there. If you look at what he did this preseason, which feels like an eternity ago, he lit it up. Now, that obviously has not translated into the regular season. You know, you got to scratch your head. What I think is more concerning from a perspective of the Eagles is their rush defense, giving up 235 yards to Doug Martin and company. Doug Martin just himself 235, and Sims 43 yards. So we're talking almost to the tune of 300 yards at the end of the day.
It's insane.
283, but you also got to factor in the additional runs. I'm sure Winston scrambled for a little bit. It's just, you're not going to win games.
Yep. Listen, if you can't stop the run in the NFL, you're not going anywhere. And if you're letting a rookie quarterback throw five touchdowns against you in 19 attempts, you're definitely not going anywhere. Listen, the Eagles are a huge disappointment. And to be honest, and I don't want to be a Nancy negative here. I'm just being real in my opinion. I feel like there aren't many great teams in the NFL this year. Besides the New England Patriots, who are always going to be up there. If they have Bill Belichick and they have Tom Brady, they're going to be up there. You can make the argument for the Carolina Panthers, too. Listen, they're undefeated. They're 10-0. But I'm just not sold on them yet. So I think besides the New England Patriots, there really aren't a lot of great teams. Like, you can look at the Packers. You can look at the Bengals. You can look at the Broncos and pinpoint, like, huge issues with all of those teams. So, to me, this has been, like, a weird year in the NFL.
You know, you say there hasn't been that many great teams, and I don't think that in and of itself is something new. I think a lot of these poor teams, or not necessarily poor, but mediocre teams, have been able to cover up their inadequacies by fantastic quarterback play. So if it's guys like Kaepernick who were supposed to be studs not panning out, RG3, I mean, if you go down the list, you'll see stars who have never been able to fill their resume post-college or post-rookie or sophomore season. Mm-hmm. So guys like Tom Brady who can hide the weaknesses in the Pats defense, or guys like Aaron Rodgers who could pick up a team when the Green Bay Packers aren't playing the ball or running the ball quite well with Eddie Lacy who gets demoted. You look at what this league has to offer, and it's going to be stability at quarterback. It's nothing new. It's the same old tire tune. If Carson Palmer's healthy, the Cardinals are going to be good. If Cam Newton is going to play on point and throw five touchdowns as well, the Panthers are going to be good. It sounds like the game of football is complex, but at the end of the day, Eric, why are we talking about the Jets being a disappointment? Quarterback.
It's about the quarterback. And it's from what – I want to ask you this question too because you're a Jet fan. 5-5, week 10 – 10 games into the season. Would you have been happy going into the year?
Yes and no, because I think some of their losses are real head-scratchers to me. You can't lose to Oakland. I understand Oakland's a better team, but you have Oakland coming east, which is difficult. Imagine them playing a game at 9 a.m. because that's what they did. You can't have them have a game like against Buffalo, where I think the Jets should have won the game. They played better. But obviously they walk away with a loss. And then you look at the Eagles game. The Jets didn't play for three quarters of the game.
That was a brutal game.
How does that happen?
Brutal. Yeah. Listen, the Jets should be better than the record. I think the Giants should be better than their record. But then again, as Bill Parcells says, you're only as good as your record. That's all that matters. So we'll transition over from NFL talk to MLB talk. If you want to give a call in, talk some Mets and Yankees, the toll-free number is 631-888-8811. That is 631-888-8811. We got about 10 minutes left in the show, so we'll touch on the Mets. So obviously this news came down last Friday, about 9 days ago, that Daniel Murphy was not re-signing his, the non-tender contract. That would have been for 1 year, $15.8 million. But now the Mets still have the option if they want to re-sign Murphy. They can offer him a deal. He's a free agent. He can re-sign anywhere. So I'm going to ask you this question, and again, this is for anyone out there. Feel free to tweet at the show. Feel free to give a call in. Would you offer Daniel Murphy a contract? And if you would, at what price would you offer him, and how many years?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it first boils down to, before you talk numbers, before you talk years, is do we think we can replicate his ability to hit the ball? And definitely at least his ability to field the ball, because that's been the drawback on Murphy when you look at his resume. with what we have internally.
Yeah.
How much do they believe in Dilson Herrera? How much do they believe on possibly bringing Flores over to second base? I mean, they have options here, especially when you have middle infielders. They're usually very versatile. They're usually very open to getting on the field because that's the hard part.
Yeah, but here's the thing. They have options, but how viable are those options? Because, listen, Dilson Herrera, Sandy Alderson and co rave about him. But from what I've seen of him on the major league level, what has he proven? Like, you know what I mean? Like, they have options, but are they good?
You know, you can rave all you want, but the production is what's going to judge if this guy is going to be a keeper, if this guy is going to be spoken about like Murphy was spoken about in the World Series, or rather in the playoffs leading up to the World Series. Now, the question about whether you re-sign Murphy, it has to be a manageable number. You're not signing a pitcher who you're going to have to worry about towards the tail end of the contract. He's a good hitter. He's a contact hitter, a short, compact swing, doesn't strike out, a guy who I could see age well, doesn't have a lot of tread on the tires. So for the right number, yeah, I'd entertain it. But
yeah,
you got to remember, you're not going to get those numbers you got in the playoffs for 162 games. You're just not.
Of course. And I think listen, I'm completely okay with getting rid of him. I'm not the biggest fan of Murphy. For a guy who's going to bat 290 and hit like 13 homers driving 70 ribbies. But then again, his fielding is definitely below subpar. He has no mental awareness in the base paths. So listen, the only reason that I would re-sign Murphy is because of depth and because of you don't know the status of David Wright. So I would re-sign Murphy and I would offer him a contract for, let's say, 3 years and $35 million. But we do have a caller on the line, and I know he's a big Met fan. He called him last week to the show, so let's get his take on this. Barry from Plainview. Barry, what's on your mind?
Hey, Dylan, Eric, and David, how are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Barry?
David, are you a Met fan like Eric and myself?
I am a Met fan. I was at Game 4 of the World Series for 7 of the 9 innings. I was in euphoria.
Okay, so you saw the ball go on Murphy's glove, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So I have a question for you guys, and I asked Eric this last week, and I know that they're talking to Ben Zobrist. I understand they had a conference call with his agent and him included, and I like Ben Zobrist a lot. He offers a lot of flexibility to play multiple positions and plays them well, but he's 35 years old. Do we know this?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Murphy's 30 years old. Look, you're going to be losing Murphy and Cespedes, and the Mets have this grand plan that Conforto will be a 300 hitter next year. Darno will be healthy. David Wright's going to play. But the fact is, Conforto showed a lot of promise, and I think he's going to be a very solid player. We can't plug him into this three-hole yet. David Wright, we don't know how his long-term health is going to be going for a full season. So what are the Mets going to do to replace this production? They can't just go back and say we have great pitching. We need to replace the production we're going to lose with Murphy and Cespedes.
I think it's going to come in the form of free agent for an outfielder. And we talked about this on the show last week. David, I want to see your opinion on this and Barry as well. But Justin Upton, the guy's a free agent, he's a free swinger, he's a home run hitter, and I think that you put him in center field to be your starter with Conforto in left, with Granderson in right, and Justin Upton is your everyday player in center field. And if you have to splurge for a guy like this and you got to pay him, let's say 7 years, $130 million, I'm completely all right with it because he's 28 and he's right in the prime of his career. So, Barry, I think to answer your question, I would go with Justin Upton.
I would love to go Justin Upton. I just don't see the Mets ownership spending that kind of money. I don't see it.
Now, if they're going to spend that kind of money, I would agree with Eric. They're going to spend the money on the younger guy who you think you're going to get the more productive years out of. But when you look at Upton, I think you see a lot of untapped potential. He has not always produced, I think. You remember him back in his days coming up with the Diamondbacks, and he was hitting mammoth shots. He was hitting bombs that were, falling into the pool in Chase Field. But you need to see him do it on a consistent basis. Of course, he did it midway through the season for the Padres against the Mets in that rain delay game where they ended up losing, which kind of spurned them to make those trades. So obviously, he did give a number for the Mets this year. But we'll see what happens. Eric, you definitely think Cespedes is a goner, no doubt about it?
Yeah, I just don't see the Mets offering him the kind of contract that he's going to want. and that he's going to deserve. I just don't see them as – listen, I would love him. Then again, I don't really know if I would give him a 6-7 year contract. He's the kind of guy that I think maybe like once he gets his money, like the effort may not be there, you know?
Now, Cespedes, if you are interested in playing golf over at Bethpage Black, we got a beautiful golf course out here. So I don't know if Sandy Alderson has pitched that to you. That might be something you like.
Yeah, I would love to have him back too. Listen, if we could get him for like 5 years, $100 million, I would do that. However, if he's going to want $7,150, I think I'd rather give that money to Upton than Cespedes.
Well, I'll tell you, you're not getting Cespedes for $500.
Of course.
He's really not going to sign for that. And long-range contract with a guy like that, I don't think would be a great idea. I do not.
Yeah.
I love Jason Hayward of St. Louis, but he's going to be demanding a lot of money. The Mets have this idea that they're going to throw Juan Lagares in center field, and they want a left-handed bat to platoon with him. And I don't know who this is going to be. They're looking at this guy. What's this guy's name on Baltimore? Who came from Milwaukee? Para. He's a lefty.
Gerardo Para, yep.
Yeah, he's a lefty. Fowler's a lefty of the Cubs. I know that. And the Cubs and Yankees are actually talking a little bit about Gardner for Castro. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Right, but and that would open up center field for Fowler to go because he might be leaving. But I think Fowler wants to play every day. I don't think he wants to come to a new team and be a platoon player. Para might be the same way. He's a nice player, Para, but not a great fielder. So then Para is going to be your center fielder against right-handed batters. I don't think he's not a very good fielder. You have to be strong up the middle in your line of defense.
Absolutely. Barry, I do appreciate the time, but our time is running low, so definitely give a call on next time, and we love hearing your opinion on the Mets. We know how passionate you are about them. It was a really fun time. Got to thank Howard Beck for coming on the show, talking some NBA and talking about the Knicks and the Nets. Special thank you to David Underweiser and Brian Graves. David, any final words?
Let's go Jets. Hopefully they wrap up the rest of the season with some gusto, as Walt Clyde Frazier would say for the Knicks.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We'll see you next weekend.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.